This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. In this episode, we'll be talking all things anxiety with Samantha Hearn. And so before we get into that, I just want to go through a few statistics and just a bit of general research I found when looking into anxiety. It's not a condition that I suffer with myself, and it's actually something I've, you know, was speaking to Pete the producer off air about, in that it's one that I'm very grateful I don't have, because I can understand in others how debilitating it can be. And I think to have that inner narrative be even louder of any kind of self-doubt or thinking of the worst case scenario, because I think to a certain extent we all have that. I certainly wouldn't want any more of that. I think that would really interfere with my life and my productivity and just take a lot of my attention off the work I love doing and being a workaholic with. So we'll just jump into a few stats here, because it is one of the most common mental health conditions, and that's why I wanted to get an episode in quite early on in our series for this. So I've got one from Mind, who found in 2016, 7.8 people out of every 100, so 7.8% you could say, experience mixed anxiety and depression. These are two conditions that very often can fit together and potentially can be symptoms and sort of have this symbiotic symptom relationship, in the same way other conditions we've mentioned before, like body dysmorphia and anorexia, can do. One can be a symptom of the other. They can also both feed each other. So it's very common for people to have anxiety and depression. In terms of just specifically anxiety, mentalhealth.org.uk found in 2013 statistics that at any given week, 6.6% of people in England had generalized anxiety. So that means this week, next week, whenever it is, in 2013, that's the level they found. It's massive. It's one of the most common mental health conditions, but it can still often be misunderstood, unfortunately. And in the episode, we get into a little bit with Sam about how people can often be very well-meaning with it, but this, you need to contribute on both sides. Whether you're someone with anxiety or whether you know someone with anxiety, you need to both learn to understand the condition better in order to support each other's understanding. That's something we cover quite a lot in the episode. And just to encourage a bit of understanding here, I have a definition of anxiety from anxietyuk.org.uk. And that is, anxiety is a normal, if unpleasant, part of life, and it can affect us all in different ways and at different times. Whereas stress is something that will come and go, as the external factor causing it, be it work, relationships or money problems, etc., comes and goes, anxiety is something that can persist whether or not the cause is clear to the sufferer. So when it's said about anxiety being part of life there, I take that to mean it's normal, it's something we go through. But in this episode, we're specifically talking about anxiety to a level of being a mental health condition. That's where it's really affecting your day-to-day life, whether that's work, whether that's relationships. It's taking up a significant amount of your time, your focus, and affecting other things. And then one last thing I'd like to mention just is, if you want to look up one more thing outside this episode, it would be a talk by Ruby Wax. If you just search for Ruby Wax TED Talk, she did a really good one on how, in her opinion, our brains aren't really adapted for the modern day. Because nowadays, anxiety and fight or flight responses, where we feel the butterflies in our tummy, where our heart rate increases, these are all things that prepare us to run or to fight, to engage in physical activity by ensuring that oxygen gets to our muscles, ready for that. But actually, that's something that is there so that we can run from predators originally. as opposed to nowadays, often we're feeling anxiety over, let's say, being late for work. And there's nothing you can do in that situation. If you're maybe taking public transport, you'll get there when you get there. But that doesn't mean the feelings are any less. And it doesn't matter, you know, if it's a traffic warden giving you a ticket, they're not a lion. They can still give you that same response. And so in the episode, we talk about where anxiety becomes such a part of your life that it is taking over. And what Sam has found and what she's taught her clients as an anxiety and mind coach to overcome such things. So we'll get into that in just a moment. But first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending Spectacles, a memoir by Sue Perkins. She's someone I'm a really massive fan of, despite the fact I don't really watch anything that she's in. But you may well know her from Bake Off, when she was in it on the BBC version. And she's just a really funny and fascinating person. She's got quite a, I'm going to stick with interesting life story. I don't even know how to describe it. There's a lot of different kind of twists and turns. There's a lot of random projects you may not have even known she was involved in. And it's really interesting to see how she got to where she is. I feel like she's got the impression of someone who's always been in the public eye, and actually she hasn't always, so it's quite nice to see kind of behind that veil.
Hello, my name's Sam. Thank you so much for having me on the episode. My journey with mental health began really when I was probably about 14. I had some really traumatic experiences happen in my childhood that were completely out of my control. There was nothing I could do to change it. And I think looking back now as an adult, that was a really big trigger for me. I was exposed to situations that I had I was helpless to, and it created emotions in me that I then had to learn how to manage, and I just didn't know where to begin. So I probably then spent about 10 years with quite severe anxiety, panic attacks, and very, very lots of insecurity around relationships and people. Mm-hmm. And that really did affect my confidence, my relationships I did have, my friendships, my education. So for me, my mental health journey did start quite young, and only when I was really old enough and mature enough and also brave enough to learn how to stop that controlling me did it really start to make a positive change. So that's a brief introduction to me and my journey.
Great, thank you. And so could you maybe give us a bit of insight into one of those experiences you went through?
Yeah, absolutely. So I lived with I've got a twin brother, and my parents separated when we were 7, which wasn't that abnormal at the time. A lot of children of my age had parents that weren't together. Mm-hmm. But I think for us, what was really different was we then stayed living with our dad. We didn't live with our mum. She moved out. And I think, so from that point, we were quite unusual children. None of our friends were in that situation. Whenever we'd meet new people, they were always surprised that we lived with our dad and not our mum. We always used to get asked questions, you know, why isn't it your mum that you live with? So from probably 7, 8, I was aware that I was different, but I didn't mind because I had a dad that was like obsessed with me and my brother, who had us later on in life. So he didn't have children, and then all of a sudden he had one of each healthy like babies. So we were surrounded by love, and I was really supported, and I felt really safe. So even though I knew I was different, I was proud to be different because I knew how much he loved me. Then when I was 14, he went in for a routine operation to have gallstones removed. So he should have been in hospital for 2 days, keyhole surgery. But the operation went wrong, and he spent 3 weeks in hospital, got pneumonia, and died. So me and my brother obviously then lost our like main source of like love and comfort, and we were just about to start our GCSEs, and my mum then had to move back into our family home. So we've gone through a very obviously unexpected, it should not have happened. My brother then became very angry. I was his kind of main source of comfort, and then our family dynamic completely changed. So that's probably, that was the real catalyst for the next few years. When I look back on it, I can see now why that was how I then manifested all of these anxious feelings and insecurities, and it definitely did start then. There was a lot of instability, a lot of change, a lot of things that happened with it. I had no control over it because obviously I was a child. Mm-hmm. There was no way I could have changed it. Nothing I did would have influenced the situation. So I think that feeling of helplessness and the choice being taken away from me really did kind of start this trigger of anxiety and not feeling like I was safe anymore. So that's probably the biggest, that's the biggest experience that I went through, yeah.
Yeah, because ultimately you grew up, by the sounds of it, in, you know, a very safe and happy home life. And so you then, as a child, that's what you're used to. That's your first-hand experience of the world. And then your dad, your main caregiver, isn't there anymore. And so I can see how very quickly you'd start to question everything and start wondering what else is going to go wrong. And really, you know, that's what anxiety is like. I don't live with it myself, but, you know, what I understand about it, it's being on that defensive, constantly waiting for something to go wrong. It's funny you should the way you talk about it, not funny, ha-ha, but it just reminded me of something I talked to a previous guest off air with, where we were trying to decipher with mental health to what extent conditions like anxiety are symptoms of what's happening in your life, and to what extent they're the problem that's causing other issues in your life. It sounds like, from what you've described so far, that it's completely, you know, logical and understandable, that reaction, and that you would then become anxious about your safety as a kid, because 14 is so young. And it's just, as you say, it's not meant to happen. You're meant to outlive the parent. That's the way it is, normally. Yeah. That's the way it should be.
Yeah, 100%. And I do. That is a very, I get asked that quite a lot, actually, around anxiety. And if it's their fault, a lot of my clients say, you know, is it something I've done wrong? Is it something that I should have changed? Is it my fault that I feel this way? Does my brain not work properly? Am I weird for having these thoughts? Am I the only person? And I definitely agree that sometimes, and every person is different, of course, and every situation is different. But with anxiety, you're so right. It's all about the unknowns and the what ifs. And if you have experienced or been exposed to a situation that has changed your life and you had no control over it, anxiety is an emotion that will definitely become exacerbated, because you are, exactly like you said, made aware of everything that could go wrong. So therefore, of course, naturally, your subconscious will start to show you the flaws rather than the amazing things that could happen, because you've experienced something abnormally wrong, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's interesting you've mentioned there with your clients how they're often asking you if it's their fault. I feel like, as an outsider, that seems quite a typical anxiety response in and of itself, that so often you're bringing things that are actually completely outside of your control into your field of awareness, and worrying on them and focusing and fixating on something that you don't have control over.
Literally, that is exactly how I used to live my life. Yeah, 100%. I would fixate on a thought, it would grow, it would become so irrational, but in my head, it was 100% true. Like, it was all I could focus on. So that, what you've just explained and described, is definitely how my brain used to function. It was the only way I knew how to function for a really long time. And for a really long time, I accepted that. That's the other big difference. A lot of people with anxiety, and again, with a lot of my clients, they just accept that that's the way it is, and they just have to live that way forever, which is not the case. But when you're exposed to thoughts and doubts and insecurities for so long, it's really hard. It's like if someone repeats anything to you enough, you would start to listen to it and acknowledge it. And especially if it's in your own head, it's so hard to then fight back and say, no, I don't want to listen to this anymore, because mm-hmm. you get so used to and so accustomed to the language and the thoughts that you have that that almost becomes a safety blanket. That almost yeah. becomes your source of, it's okay, I know this is how I am, this is just me, it's just me, I'm just anxious. Mm-hmm. And you almost start to use that as your protection. So yeah. it definitely, 100%, is, I agree with everything you've said, you know, it is a characteristic, and they are statements that a lot of people that experience anxiety would experience without a shadow of a doubt.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good point, what you said there about how you become, you internalize the anxiety and you can almost make it part of you and start to identify with it more and more. I think that's something that's really across the board quite common with mental health, is that because it's this internal battle, you can find ways to identify with it, and actually you can internalize it in ways that are very unhealthy and start to think that, you know, this is the way I am, this is the way I'll always be. And in reality, for better or for worse, it's an internal battle. You're the one that's going to be the victim, but you're also the one that ultimately, I think, holds the key to really fixing it. You know, absolutely, there's the support from medical professionals. There's, you know, coaches like yourself. There's counselling. There's so many things out there. But ultimately, you have to be present in all of those things. You can't just go and sit and be fixed.
No, 100%. You have to make that choice. 100%. You have to be willing. You have to choose to want things to be different, mm-hmm. definitely. And even if that's really scary and you have no idea what that will mean or what that will look like or where it will take you, just saying to yourself, this isn't enough anymore and I'm not happy, I want more for my life, that decision is enough to bring to the table and ask for support, exactly like you said, in all of those avenues, because you now know and acknowledge within yourself that you want to try something else. You want to see if there is another way to think and feel, and to even have that thought and allow it to be strong enough to turn into any form of action is definitely the best way to start the process. But ultimately, I agree, you have to make that choice to want to move things forward for yourself. That is yeah. ultimately, yes, you have to start there, definitely.
And with that then, out of interest, what you talked about with your anxiety becoming like a safety blanket, sounds like that's in lieu of perceived stability in the outside world. And mm-hmm. then with that, how did you find yourself or maybe your clients then respond to other people? Because I think the temptation for someone that doesn't have anxiety, if they see you or hear you talk about something that sounds, you know, overblown, that you've put too much thought into, that you're thinking of the worst case scenario, the temptation to people that know you then is, oh, don't worry about it, it's not going to happen, everything's going to be fine. And how do you respond to that?
Good question. I think the biggest thing for me is I've always been very eloquent with my emotions. I've always been able to, I always found that helpful for me to be very vocal. Mm-hmm. What really helped me and also helped my loved ones is I would explain myself and it would be irrational and quite dramatic. You know, I just can't carry on. Like, not as in suicidal, I can't carry on, but as in, I just literally have nowhere to turn. This thought has been taken over my mind for like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I literally can't get out of my head. You know, what am I going to do? But when I would share that with other people, I would also put it into context. So I would say the background behind it. So I'd always say things like, you know, I'm really worried that this person doesn't want to be my friend anymore because I text them and it's been 12 minutes and they haven't texted me back and I know they're feeling on their phone. Mm-hmm. What if they have found me annoying, or what if I'm not good enough? And I'd always say, I know it might seem really irrational to you, but in my head, this, I literally have no other thought. You have to help me out. I need to have other options. Mm-hmm. So I would always acknowledge that the other person would probably think that what I'm thinking is extreme. So I would address that before they gave me advice. And I would say, I know that you're going to see this as irrational, But right now, I need you to give me options. I need you to give me solutions. I need you to give me other thoughts I could have. So mm-hmm. I would make it very clear why I was sharing it, for one, but two, what I wanted from them. So then they didn't give me the whole superficial, just calm down. They would say, okay, Sam, that's fine. If you want options, what about they're driving? What about if they are on a commute and they have no signal? Mm-hmm. What about if they're speaking to their boyfriend on the phone and they're driving so they can't text you back? Like, could those things be options? And I'd be like, oh, actually, yeah, they could be. And they'd say, okay, well, why don't we just think about the options? So I would always go, whenever I sought help, I would always make it very clear what I wanted from that person, mm-hmm. because otherwise, and I did learn this, it was very frustrating when people at the beginning did just say, you just need to calm down. You know, that is obviously not the problem. What's wrong with you? I would then come off that phone call feeling even worse. Mm-hmm. So I learned quite quickly that I needed to kind of direct my loved ones so that they felt like they had a purpose as well, because a lot of the time they just feel helpless. They want mm-hmm. to help you, but they literally don't know what to say because you're already in that irrational, frantic state. So anything they say would fall on deaf ears. So mm-hmm. I tried my best, no matter how irrational I felt, to always at least ask for something specific. You know, if I was with someone face to face, I might even say things like, I don't even want you to talk. I just need you to give me a cuddle. I just need you to hold my hand. I just need you to like listen to this song with me. I would be very clear as to what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think that helped me, but it also helped them to know what they could do that would actually be beneficial. Sure. And it helped me to start to identify what I could, like now, I can do all of those things for myself. I can self-soothe, I can pacify my own thoughts. But that on my journey, and everyone will be different, but for me, that was almost the start of me acknowledging, I know this is what I need, but I just can't quite give it to myself yet. I can't quite reassure myself, so I need mm-hmm. you to do that for me. And they would all, that was really helpful. So
that's
that would
so great.
Be, yeah.
I love that. That's a really great technique. You've explained that really well, because, and that's really answered my question as well in terms of, as outsiders to anxiety, how can we come at it better? So what you've talked about there is really up the street of what this podcast is about, is trying to break down that stigma by taking the time to explain, by giving your family or friends the chance to help in a way that's meaningful, in a way that's helpful, because otherwise their default is going to be something that isn't necessarily helpful. You've reminded
Absolutely.
Me of a parallel we had in another episode on eating disorders, where the guest was talking about how in most cases it's the worst thing you can do to comment on the appearance of someone with an eating disorder, because they're trying so hard to direct their focus away from that. And even
yeah.
if you're saying something nice, they're likely to twist it or ignore it. And so I wonder then, in terms of what you talked about with the safety blanket feeling of anxiety, did you ever feel that when people tried to help and they came at you with more general things, you know, just like, oh, it's fine, you're overthinking it, rather than specifically getting into the scenario and trying to break it down with you, did you find that then made you defensive?
Good question. Also, just before I answer that, mm-hmm. to give one more snippet of advice based on what I just said, uh-huh. if your loved one isn't able to tell you what they want yet, and they haven't quite worked that out, the best advice I would give to the loved one is, before you offer any advice, listen to what they're saying and just simply say, is there anything I could do to make this better? Mm-hmm. So before you offer any statements or any reassurance, just simply ask them, what can I do to help make this better? How can I make you feel better? And if they say, I don't know, then start down the route of asking about why they feel that way. So try as much as possible to steer clear of those general statements mm-hmm. and ask questions. Try and dig a bit deeper to help the person understand their own feelings, but for you to understand it more. So if your anxious loved one isn't quite ready to say what they need directly, just make sure you're coming from a place of support, but also questions. How can I make this better? What can I do? Because you don't feel anxious and you feel very rational and calm, mm-hmm. and that's what they need from you. They need you to be able to kind of take control, almost be that loving figure of, it will be okay, but saying that to you right now, you won't believe. So I need to think of other ways I can take back control of this situation and at least direct the conversation into a purpose. So that would just be another snippet of advice for the loved ones. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, I also, and this is something for the anxious person, but also the anxious supporters, you will very quickly learn which people are going to listen, actively listen, mm-hmm. and which people will passively listen. So, and this is a really good tip for the anxious supporter. If you're a passive listener, you will, and I had this, so my anxiety was a daily ordeal. That's the word I would use. It wasn't ordeal. It wasn't a daily struggle. It literally was daily, like, trauma. It was so debilitating. So my loved ones and my now husband were like, Sam, we've had this conversation 20 million times. I don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. But if they were passively listening, then they would make the general comments. You're going to be okay. Come on. We've done this before. Don't worry about it. Just focus on something else. Go for a walk. Mm-hmm. If they were actively listening, they would be able to say, okay, well, last Wednesday, you also felt like this when you talked about this same friend. Have you told this friend that if they don't text you back, you're going to get worried? Why won't you just call them instead of texting them? So if they're actively listening, they'll be able to put you in situations you've been in before, remind you of what you did to make that better, and recall information that made you move forward because they're actively there with you. So you as the person that experiences anxiety need to just be mindful. And it is a trap we can fall into. When you feel anxious, you'll share it with anyone. You just want to get it out there in the world and just literally blurt, like brain dump. But there will be people that are better for you to do that with rather than just the first person you see and think, right, I'm going to just try and speak to them and see if they make me feel better. Mm-hmm. So my advice for the anxious person, have a bank of people that you know will actively listen and actually question your reactions. So it's not them judging you, but it's about them saying, look, yesterday someone didn't text you back for 20 minutes and it was all right. Why today is it so bad? Have you had a stressful day? Are you tired? Has something happened at work or school or whatever? And then as the loved one, really just try and make sure that if they are telling you how they feel, for them to be vocalizing their struggles, it has to be literally all they can think about. So for them, it's their number one and only priority. Mm-hmm. So if they're coming to you with these thoughts and these emotions, just make sure you give them the time to really actively listen. And again, challenge the thoughts. Why do you think you're going to have a car crash? Why do you think that? Because when you went to work today, you were totally fine. So you then actively engage in the conversation. So mm-hmm. for me, I did at the beginning not become defensive. I almost was offended. Rather than becoming defensive, I was hurt by them saying, you're going to be fine. Because I thought, I'm not going to be fine. Here, I'm in this like state of panic, like literally the world is going to end. I'm obviously not going to be fine. What are you saying to me? I get really kind of frustrated and like, oh my gosh, I am telling you the world is over and you're telling me just to brush it off. That is not realistic to me right now. So I then had to learn who is actually going to be in the conversation with me and really try and almost jump into your head with you and say, like, it's almost like you need someone to get inside your brain and declutter all the stuff, like a parent would clean your room and be like, okay, Sam, let's just take this one step at a time. So I would say the biggest piece of advice in this situation is think about the active and the passive listeners. And also, if you are the listener, are you giving them real, tangible information, or are you just trying to end the conversation as quickly as possible?
Mm-hmm.
That would be my take on that.
Yeah, no, I love that. The way I would generally describe that is, from an outside party, the ability to sit in the emotions and the situation with someone, because only then can you start to really try and see it from their eyes, trying to really empathise. And as you say, you learn very quickly who can do that and who can't. But I'd say if you're on the other side of it, you still need to give people a chance. You know, many people we've talked to on the show already have had a bad first experience when they've talked about mental health, and that's really put them off. But if this show can show anything, there's so many people out there that are able to talk about mental health like adults, who aren't going to judge you, who want to understand what you're going through. And it reminds me as well, the way you've described it, of counselling, because a lot of certain types of counselling, like person-centred, are about trying to bring things into your field of awareness that you can't see. So whether that's something as simple as, oh, but this same person didn't text you back last week, and then they did, do you think maybe they're just slow at texting back? And then, you know, and sometimes it can just be something simple like that that interrupts your negative thinking, and you're just like, oh, well, no, that's true. I do continually have this problem. And often it can take someone else, whether that's a professional or just a friend or family member, to see these patterns, because with, you know, many mental health conditions, you can be so in it and so in your head with it that you, it stops you seeing them.
100%.
Yeah. So I'm interested then in terms of how that journey worked for you then. So you learned, it sounds like, quite early on to better express yourself and explain to family and friends what you need. And then where did, could you talk us through where it went from there to where you are now?
Yeah, so when my dad died, me and my brother were both kind of put through counselling. Obviously, you know, it was probably the easiest kind of route to offer support for us. But for both of us, it didn't have the effect it should have. And when I look back now, I think we were both just really vulnerable, you know. We were still kids. And although we'd been through this traumatic experience, we had no idea what that would mean for us as we grew up, you know. We didn't realise actually the impact it would have. So it was almost too early, because it was too fresh. You know, we were still focused on the fact he wasn't here, whereas when I was, you know, 21, I was focused on the fact he wouldn't walk me down the aisle, you know. So my concerns and my challenges with him not being here changed as I grew older. So we both went for counselling at 14, and both decided it wasn't quite right, which I do think, looking back, was the right choice, because we were still doing our GCSEs. We still had to almost try and just get through that 2 years and be a teenager. You know, our friends hadn't experienced it. They didn't have a clue what to say. And I think as much as possible, we kind of just wanted to put the blinkers on and just literally get to the end, you know, get the GCSEs and see what happens. But then for me, very different to my brother, it did obviously have a massive impact on my life in everything. So when I was 22, because another piece of that puzzle, when I was 20, my mum then moved to Jamaica. So she left the country. My brother then had to move to Scotland to be with his now wife. So at 20, I lost everything. I had no family home. I had no family. I was completely on my own. And again, that was, there was nothing I could have done about that. So I didn't then have birthdays with my twin. I didn't have Christmases. I didn't have a family Christmas. I didn't have a home. That was probably the nail in the coffin, in the sense of it couldn't get much worse. You know, literally, I was totally, I just started to build myself back up. I was in my final year of university. I worked really hard. I've always been really resilient, and I definitely get that from my dad. You know, I finally kind of, let's do this, you know, really, let's go for it. And I was just completely hit by a steam train, you know, no way, Sam, you know, you know, let's just throw another sort of storm at you. And I just remember thinking, I just can't do this again. I cannot go through this again. what am I going to do now? So I think when I got to about 22, I graduated from uni, so I had to work full-time and study full-time. That was really hard in itself. I graduated uni with a first, which I was so proud of. You know, I worked so hard to get where I got to. I then started teaching, so I was probably about 22, and I met my now husband. Mm-hmm. And that was the turning point of, you can't do this anymore, Sam. It's affecting the only good thing you've got in your life, the only person that does love you and is here, the only person that is literally your constant, and you're pushing him away because you think he's going to leave. You know, I was horrendous. You know, I don't know how he managed me for that long. And I just, then I decided I need to take it into my own hands and I had to get help because I didn't want my past and other people's decisions, because that was the most important thing. I hadn't chosen any of this for myself, but yet it was affecting my life. Like, my mental health was affected by everyone else's decisions around me. And actually, I was the one suffering. And I just thought, I don't want this anymore. I want to be happy. So I then went back to counselling. About 21.
Can we just pause there for a moment? It's just interesting what you're talking about in terms of the turning point for you. Because I think that's something we've seen in a lot of our guests, and I've seen a lot in people that I know outside of the podcast, is that life has this curious way of giving you all that you can handle. And sometimes you need that. You need that breaking point to push you over some kind of tipping point to really make a change. And it's something that's so common with guests and people we speak to. And so it's really good to hear that you've been through that and you've made the changes, but also maybe take a moment to acknowledge that it often does get to that really bad point so that it can get better. You know, sometimes you need to hit rock bottom.
Yeah, 100%. And I talk about this a lot with my community. You know, I am in no way ashamed of the journey that I've been on, and I definitely do talk very openly about it. And you're right, I hit rock bottom. You know, I was at that point where I was completely defeated. Everything that could have gone wrong felt like it went wrong. You know, I actually thought to myself when this came about, and, you know, I've met Lou, I thought to myself, I'm so young and I feel like I have experienced things that people at 60 don't know what that is yet. I was sort of like, what? How has this happened in such a short space of time? Mm-hmm. And I definitely did hit rock bottom. I just knew I couldn't carry on like that. It was such a struggle. And I was so desperately unhappy with who I was becoming. I was so desperately unhappy with the thoughts that I continued to have. And they just wouldn't go away, even though I wanted them to. And I was like, come on, you know, you can do this. You've done it before. It's almost like I had no more fight left on my own. I couldn't do it on my own anymore. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't bounce back. You know, I needed that support. And I think, you know, so I then decided to go back to counselling and, you know, seek that support and seek that help. And I was finally ready to move my life. I was ready to move my life forward. I made the decision that my life was mine. And it wasn't as a result of my mum leaving. It wasn't a result of my dad dying. It wasn't a result of my brother leaving. It wasn't a result of all of these things happening. I wanted to be the result of my life. I wanted to take back control. And I wanted my thoughts to be mine. I didn't want to constantly be worried about everyone else all the time and worried about what could go wrong and worried about the risks and the judgments and people not loving me and, you know, being this sort of, you know, black sheep. I didn't want that anymore, and I wanted to make my life better. So I went back to counselling for probably about 18 months, really intensively. I went once a week, and I was fully committed. Luke was also committed. You know, I would come home with tasks for him to do, and he was brilliant. You know, like, when I think about it now, I am, you know, it does make me emotional because I'm so grateful that I did have someone that was willing to do it with me. You know, he loved me enough to make the changes with me and support me and do everything he had to do to help make the situation better. And for me, that will always be a priceless memory of this whole experience. It made me realize that if you do trust someone enough with your happiness and they are the right person, there will always be support for you outside of counselling. You know, you can come away with it and grow and then live on your own past the counselling, you know, which I definitely did do. You know, I then, after 18 months, I went every other week. Then I went once a month. And then I said to her, let's just leave the door open. Mm-hmm. And it's been 5 years now, and now I'm an anxiety coach. So yeah, the journey has taken me on a massive roller coaster. But yeah, 100%, I'm not ashamed to say that I definitely had to hit rock bottom, and I had to realise that this was totally making me painfully unhappy, and I wanted to... I was finally ready to make that change, exactly like we spoke about at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what would happen. My first experience with counselling wasn't great, like I explained. You know, I was too young. I didn't really know the ins and outs. So I did have that apprehension. I did worry that it wouldn't work again, and maybe I can't be fixed, and maybe there is this problem with me. I did think of that. But I had the initial thought of, there has to be something better. We need to find it. Mm-hmm. And I did. So the choice I made was enough to get me started. And since then, I've never looked back. I've continued to grow. I've continued to develop. I continue to read. I continue to challenge myself. I continue to support others outside of my business, you know, in general life. Mm-hmm. And I think that it has given me the tools and the strategies to identify in myself, but also in other people, when it is the time to seek that support. So I am grateful for the journey, but it did take a long time for me to be able to say that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Well, it's definitely, none of what you've talked about sounds easy, but it does sound so relatable and hopefully accessible for our listeners or anyone that hears this going through anxiety. It's really great as well to hear what you said about your relationship and how supportive that was. You know, that really touched something for me of, you know, that was the most supportive person in your life. And other than all the others you've mentioned, this was the first time that it was someone not related to you. And yeah, there's such power in that someone was able to support you in that way. And if I could say, you know, one thing to the listeners about that, and very briefly touch on relationships, if they matter, if they are good enough for you, and if they're really invested in you being the best possible self and your happiness, they'll do all of that and far more to be there for you. So if you're in a relationship where you don't find that, maybe think about it. And if you're in a relationship where you do see that and they're really turning up for you, like we've discussed before, let them in. They're there to help. They love you. They want to support you.
100%. And there's a really simple statement that I always say that actually is exactly what you said. The mm-hmm. right people will always give you the right support. And that doesn't mean that they agree with everything that you do. You know, Luke definitely challenged me along the way, but it was always right for me. He had my best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. So if he said to me, Sam, you are letting your anxiety take control, we need to take a minute. He did challenge me. He did hold me to account. He did give me tough love, but it was all with my best interest. And along with that, he did endlessly listen. He did love me. He mm-hmm. did accept the flaws. So the right people will always give you the right support, and it will always be with your best interest at heart. So definitely, to reinforce what you said, if you are in a relationship and they do challenge you, that doesn't mean they don't love you. It means that they know you are capable of better, and mm-hmm. they want that for you. And actually, sometimes we need that challenge because we aren't challenging ourselves, and we're doing what we've always done and just accepted the anxiety. So the right people will always give you the right support.
Yeah, great. All right, I think that's a good place to finish there, and a good strong message to finish us out with. Just to very briefly lighten it up for a moment, could you tell us a little bit more about your show? Because if anyone's heard what you've talked about today and particularly connected with it, you know, this is only a very small segment of all the incredible insight you share every week on your podcast.
Yeah, my God. Yeah, so, yes, I am an anxiety coach, but my podcast, my business, everything is called A Happy Mind. It's exactly what it says on the tin. The aim is to allow you to access and have your own happy mind. So although I do talk exactly like we've talked about, you know, very sincere topics and, you know, really honest and open, vulnerable things around anxiety, the majority of what I do is focused on the positives of how you can get to where you want to go, how you can have your happy mind. So the podcast is filled with positivity, empowerment, motivation, support. And like I say in the podcast, it's just a way for me to give a virtual hug. You know, like, we are all in this together, and mental health is not something that you need to struggle with on your own. And it's also not something you should be afraid of or worried about, because there is positives to come from it. So everything I do is all around how you can move forward. I try as much as possible to offer solutions and offer strategies and tips that people can take away literally from right then and there and have more of a happy mind, because ultimately that's what we all want. So that's what I try and do, along with the serious stuff. And I think it's really important to do that. So, yeah, it's all around building and having your happy mind, and me being able to give you simple, relatable, honest ways you can do that.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. So, yes, you can find A Happy Mind on wherever you get podcasts. And also, in a moment, you'll be our recommended social media as well. So thank you so much for being a part of the show and taking the time to talk to us. I've really enjoyed just hearing more about you and your story. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And now, an account for a healthier online world.
This week I'm recommending Samantha Hearn's Instagram account. She's this week's guest, and you can find her on Instagram at a.happy.mind. And it's really the best place to go if you want to learn more about what she does, keep up to date on when her podcast releases are, and just get general uplifting content. You can tell she puts a lot of work into her social media. Almost all the photos have her like favourite theme colour yellow in, and every one of them she's taken the time to put in like a motivational or insightful message. And craft that depending on, you know, events or whatever she's going through. So definitely the go-to place to learn anything more about this week's guest. If you haven't already heard, we've started a petition to make mental health education mandatory in all schools. If this is something that you're passionate about too, and you'd consider signing such a petition or even just reading about it to learn more, you can find it by visiting bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link for this is also in the description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.